Disc 3.
Truth exists, my mind was shrieking. It doesn't matter what it is or where it is. Somewhere, somehow, there is truth. I don't care if it's in Christianity or Judaism or Islam or in the most despised cult in the deepest bowels of depravity. It exists, and I will not spend another minute of my life flailing blindly around in the filth and miasma of ignorance for any other reason than to find it. The universe isn't vague and ignorant. I am vague and ignorant. Something is true, and it doesn't matter what it is. I'm not going to be false anymore. I have not even the slightest trace of the slightest reservation about the fact that I would rather suffer and die figuring out what is true than continue this life as a slave to lies and ignorance. I just reread those last few paragraphs, and they come somewhat close to what my brain looked like after the explosion. Death, rebirth, events come in all shapes and sizes, and this was my first step. This was the one that separates who I was from what I am now. That was the day I set fire to my life and went to war. The next 2 years were spent in a state of burning obsession. I quit my job, dumped my belongings, and moved from Chicago to a small town in Iowa. I scoured bookstores and took full advantage of the local library's statewide lending program. I bought a computer and spent hours every day hunched over the keyboard trying to express the truth. I read and I wrote. I edited, discarded, and rewrote. Every few weeks I would delete all my files, reformat all my disks, and burn, literally, in a kettle barbecue, all my notes and handwritten pages. I almost never read anything I wrote because the mere act of writing it rendered it obsolete in my thinking. I severed all ties, no job, no friends, no family, and had only a few possessions. I did nothing else. I had no other thought. I went for long walks, thinking, pounding away at whichever door I was stuck behind at the moment. And then one day, after a couple of years of this, I was suddenly done. Just like that. Done. Although I didn't think of it in these terms, I had become enlightened, satoried, awake, truth-realized, a Jnani, Buddha, whatever you want to call it. Getting the hang of this new state, however, would take me another decade. I've been asked if I'd do it all over again if I had the choice, but it's not something I chose in the first place. There was never any decision. I never made any choice. It's not like a career path where you set your sights and go after it. It's more like you're walking along a mountain path that suddenly turns to mud, and you find yourself hurtling at breakneck speed into the unknown. And before too long, hurtling at breakneck speed into the unknown becomes your reality. And then, one day, equally without warning, you're launched into empty space. And, before too long, empty space becomes your reality. That's where I am now. Empty space is my reality. The void. No self. I abide in non-dual, non-relative awareness. This is the part that can't be explained. I can't frame it in words, even for myself. No one can say I am enlightened, because there is no I to it. There is no such thing as an enlightened person. The person writing these words, the person that speaks to the students, isn't the enlightened one. My personality, my ego, what appears to be me, is just an afterimage, a physical apparition based on residual energy patterns. Jed McKenna is like the outfit an invisible man wears so that he can interact with people without freaking them out. So, anyway, that's a little bit about me.
Chapter 9. Both in and out of the game. Apart from the pulling and hauling, stands what I am. Stands amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary. Looks down, is erect, or bends an arm on an impalpable certain rest. Looking with side-curved head, curious what will come next. Both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. Walt Whitman.
Chapter 10. Why chatter about delusion and enlightenment? Thus shall ye think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bauble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. Buddha. It's Thursday night, prime time, so most of the gang is down in the basement TV room watching the week's best lineup of shows. I like sitcoms and dramas when they're well written and somewhat fresh, so I quietly slip into the back of the room and take a seat. Several people see me come in and begin to react, but I wave them down and they get the idea. When discussing personal tastes like food or music or TV and movies and whatnot, I would never mean to suggest that my tastes are in any way elevated. I have a fairly narrow band of appreciation, but it has little to do with enlightenment stuff. With TV, movies, and novels, I don't shun horror or violence. I get weepy at the right parts. I laugh when something strikes me as funny. The willing suspension of disbelief may come a little harder for me than most, not in the conventional sense, but in the sense of forming an empathetic bond with the plight of the characters. The same holds true in real life. I see people fulfilling their roles and acting like themselves, and I tend to forget that they really identify with their character and their character's plight. There's some whispering in the room as word of my presence is passed around. Some heads turn. People smile. I don't come down here often. Don't do the mingling thing much, but tonight I just felt like watching something with other people. I'm a little concerned that my presence will detract from the viewing for the group. But there's nothing wrong with making them a little uncomfortable now and then. Maybe it will get them to somehow reevaluate their own views of the programs we're watching. Maybe my presence will make them self-conscious so they observe themselves, observing dramatic performances, which might in turn encourage them to become detached observers in their own dramatic performances. Or maybe we're all just vegging out in front of the TV. I'm not really a people person. I don't understand people, and I don't identify with them. I don't identify with my own status as a man, or a person, or a human being. I have a very distinct impression of life as a stage drama, and I find it endlessly mystifying that anyone truly identifies with their character. I watch my own life with amused detachment. I may be doing this or that, fulfilling my role, but I'm almost always out in the seats somewhere, watching it all, as unprepared for the next thing I do as anyone else. Being a detached observer is nearer my reality, and I find it belief-defying that everyone isn't the same, that they're up in their characters, playing out all this life stuff like it's for real. Sometimes I think that grabbing them by the shoulders and shaking or slapping them will snap them out of it. Not really, but kind of. I watch myself being wisdom guy, and I can't believe anyone really falls for it. I can't believe that this stuff isn't obvious to everybody. Truth doesn't need to be sought. because it isn't lost. It's not at the end of some path waiting to be discovered. It's not the result of practice or growth or learning. Truth is everywhere, at all times, never absent, never distant. Truth isn't the tricky thing. It's the simplest thing there is. In fact, truth is that which can't be simplified further. Possessing the ability not to see truth, now that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. In fact, I would never believe it was even possible if I hadn't done it myself for 30 years. I look back on my own life before enlightenment as a sleep state from which I was able to rouse myself, and I think of everyone I see as being in that same sleep state, like somnambulists sleepwalking and sleep-talking through life. This view is not peculiar to me. Anyone who was awake would say the same thing. I see my role as being someone who shines a light into sleeping minds, and if they're looking for it, and if they want to awaken, and if they're willing to struggle upward out of the clinging grasp of the dream state, then maybe I can be of assistance. I don't see it as my role to save or rescue anybody, any more than regular people feel the need to rescue each other from sleeping and dreaming. I don't think of people as victims or patients or in any way defective, just asleep. Some will emerge from their dream state, and I may play a role in that, or I may be of some assistance to them once they're awake. I'm a gate tender. I holler through the portal, and those that can hear me receive a sense of direction, and those that come through find a friend to welcome them. Tonight's shows are pretty good, a bunch of comedies and a one-hour drama. It's getting near the end of the season, so the comedies are trying to deepen our love for them, and the drama is building up to its suspenseful cliffhanger, all in an effort to still be our favorites when the distant fall season begins. It's not long before I find it a little irksome to be sitting in a basement watching facile TV antics when it's such a beautiful and long-awaited spring evening outside. So I go upstairs, grab one of Satyam Nadine's books, and go out on the front porch to read. As I rock back and forth in a porch glider, my mind strays from the words on the page to the number of people who seem to be around these days. What are they coming out for? Some I know are coming out 4 or 5 times for every one meeting they're having with me. This place is developing into something, and I don't know what. I'm amused by the thought that we might have to build bunkhouses, and remind myself not to joke about bunkhouses aloud, or a few weeks later I'll look out the window, and there they'll be. That's how it is in dreams. Thoughts become things practically before they're thought. It occurs to me that people are coming out because they think they'll benefit simply by being near me. I wouldn't care to see things develop along those lines. I can see where people would want to perform selfless service, so they might be coming out, tithing to the household, laboring for whatever ideal they feel the house represents, bringing gifts, all in the hope of what? Earning merit? Burning karma? Exhibiting unconditional love for its own sake? I don't really have a clue. Of course, some are here mainly for Sonoya. She doesn't teach or even speak much outside the normal course of getting things done. And yet, she possesses that which so many seek, perfect equanimity. The people that come out here seem to enjoy working for her, as if they had been wanting to give of themselves, but were unable to find the right framework within which to do so. Sonoya combines the attributes of selflessness and causelessness, allowing people to give of themselves not for the higher good of some doctrine or organization, but simply for the giving. I can see where people would want to do that, and I can see where it might be difficult to find an outlet for such a desire. In Sonoya, they see selflessness perfected, poise, balance, unerring rightness, and that provides them with a shining example of where the path of selfless service leads. Very interesting, the direction this Iowa farmhouse is taking, the thing, whatever it is, that it's evolving into. I'll have to think about this some more, or not. The fact is that everything goes along perfectly well without me sticking my nose in. Another fact is that I really don't care who's coming or why. It's a nice place, and it has a nice feeling to it, and that hasn't changed. We're not throwing kegger parties at night that I've noticed. Nobody's running around naked or sacrificing squirrels that I've noticed. I don't think the place is turning into a commune, and I'm reasonably sure Sonea wouldn't let it. Annie runs out and curls up in my lap. She sticks her thumb in her mouth and is instantly asleep. I can't read with her here, so I set the book down and enjoy the evening. A poem by Ryokan comes to mind. Too lazy to be ambitious, I let the world take care of itself. 10 days' worth of rice in my bag, a bundle of twigs by the fireplace. Why chatter about delusion and enlightenment? Listening to the night rain on my roof, I sit comfortably with both legs stretched out. One of my favorites. Chapter 11. Kill the Buddha. Do not seek to follow in the footsteps of the wise. Seek what they sought. Basho. It's raining. Thunder and lightning are slashing and crashing through the sky. Thoreau called himself the self-appointed inspector of snowstorms and rainstorms, and if he meant that he was so enthralled by them that he felt compelled to observe them, even if it meant getting out of a warm bed to do so, then I know what he meant. And I, too, am a self-appointed inspector of snowstorms and rainstorms. It's early morning, the sun just recently up, and the storm has pulled me from sleep. I am wrapped in a blanket and tucked cozily into a chair on the west-facing second-floor porch just off my bedroom. Most of our weather comes in from the west. I always have the feeling that storms are spectacles for my personal entertainment, and I feel a pang of guilt if I don't pay attention to them. It's no hardship to pay attention to them, though, since they provide me such pleasure. I think of storms as boisterous sound and light shows put on by the universe for those who have the sense to appreciate the majesty and grandeur of them. Nothing to do with enlightenment, just something I like. Andrew is the only guest who ever sat out here on the second floor porch with me. They usually don't come near the master suite at all, unless it's for their chores, and usually when I'm somewhere else. It's embarrassing, really. After all, there's no earthly reason why I shouldn't make my own bed. I don't know whatever happened in my life that I have people doing all my stuff for me. Actually, I do bully my way into the kitchen after dinner once in a while, order everyone out, and clean the dinner mess by myself. I don't do it to be a good guy or to make a point. I do it because I enjoy it. I like washing the dishes and cleaning the kitchen. Go figure. I invited Andrew up one day last summer during an afternoon storm. I liked Andrew personally. He was in his mid-30s, slim, soft-spoken, and had been a Buddhist for most of his adult life. As I recall, he was a practitioner of Vipassana meditation, which may have explained his air of quiet self-composure. I wanted someone to watch the storm with, and Andrew seemed a good choice, meaning that he seemed likely to sit quietly and appreciate the storm. Which he did. When it was mostly over, we poured tea and discussed his relationship with Buddhism. I was interested to hear his views and experiences. I've never really understood Buddhism conceptually. I understand Zen perfectly, at least my own highly distilled version of it. But, strange as it may sound, I've never really made the connection between Zen and Buddhism. For one thing, I never figured out how desire got to be the bad guy and compassion became the good guy. Suzuki said that Buddhism wasn't something you had deep feelings for, that just doing normal things like eating meals and going to bed was Buddhism. I read books about it, and now and then I kind of get it, but mostly I don't. The reason I don't get it, I think, is because I keep thinking that the point of Buddhism is waking up from delusion, but maybe it's not. Maybe the point is just eating meals and going to bed. What drew Andrew to Buddhism was interesting, but hearing him talk about it only reinforced my belief that it was something I didn't get. I'm not a theologian, of course, and I have not made a deep study of world religions, but to the degree that I have looked at them, I have no problem understanding what they're about. Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are all about keeping God happy so he keeps us happy. Hinduism is similar, but with more gods. But even at that oversimplistic level, Buddhism eludes me. Frankly, I think it eludes many of its practitioners as well, as the discussion with Andrew would tend to bear out. He was stuck on several points, he said. We discussed a few of them that I'll share here because they reveal important lessons for anyone who is trying to break free from the bonds of delusion, as we say in the Enlightenment game. What Andrew had to say about the Buddhist concept of non-attachment was not so much that he didn't understand it as that he was having trouble achieving it. That, of course, led to the apparent paradox of the desire to be desireless, being itself a desire, and that whole tail chase. Rather than drawing him out on the subject, I decided to simply drone on about it for a while and see how he responded. Andrew didn't need to be finessed like some of the others. He had the courage and intelligence to see when shown. There are two ways to look at non-attachment. One is in the context of living a peaceful, happy life. The other is in the context of becoming awake from delusion. Nirvana, I suppose. Am I correct in believing that Buddhism often has as its goal serenity, freedom from suffering, that sort of thing? Andrew confirmed that living a fulfilled and contented life was very much at the heart of Buddhism, but added that enlightenment, nirvana, was closer to his own. Then you'll be happy to know that you can forget about non-attachment, I said. You're putting the cart before the horse. Non-attachment isn't a key to liberation. It's a byproduct. The attachment thing is just a symptom of a larger and more interesting malady chronically plaguing earnest seekers. More interesting to me, anyway. This is a very common error that's found throughout the world's teachings and religions, I continue. They're often 180 degrees removed from the truth. It's the belief that if you want to be Christ-like, then you should act more like Christ, as if the way to become something is by imitating it. If you want to be an enlightened person, the thinking goes, you should act like an enlightened person. Utter nonsense, of course, but widely accepted. Once you're able to recognize this fallacy, you'll be amazed by how common it is. For instance, I myself am enlightened, and I possess effortless non-attachment. I know what it is, and I know what they mean by it because I have it. I'm not attached to it. I don't cultivate it. In fact, I don't think I ever gave it much thought until I had to answer questions about it. It's just something that came with the deal, a byproduct. There are many byproducts of enlightenment, but cultivating them, no matter how devoutly, would never actually bring about enlightenment. It's easy to look at an enlightened guy and say, hey, he only eats rice. We must only eat rice if we wish to attain nirvana. But, of course, that's not true. If the enlightened guy jumped off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge? Andrew laughs politely. If the enlightened guy jumped off a bridge, I repeat, would you jump off a bridge? He doesn't laugh this time. It's everywhere, I continue. You see it all the time. Why should I turn the other cheek if someone belts me, and I want to belt him back? To act like Christ? When did I get into the acting like Christ business? Some great sage in India only sits facing north, so now I have to face north all the time? What if sage guy is a nose picker? Do I have to face north and pick my nose 8 times a day? Why? Because my mission in life is to imitate great sages? I don't think so. Say I'm well-fed and you're starving. You come to me and ask how you can be well-fed. Well, I've noticed that every time I eat a good meal, I belch. So I tell you to belch, because that means you're well-fed. Totally backward, right? You're still starving, and now you're also off-gassing like a pig. And the worst part of the whole deal, pay attention to this trick, the worst part is that you've stopped looking for food. Your starvation is now assured. I let that one sink in for a few moments. There are important lessons here, and I don't want to race through them too quickly. The little questions are always portals into larger answers. The non-attachment thing is the same, I continue. If you're looking at it as a key to peace and happiness, then I can't discuss it with any authority, except to say that it sounds a little dull. However, if you're looking at it as an important step on the path to awakening, then I can assure you that it's not. Wake up first, and then you can have non-attachment by the truckload. We discussed non-attachment some more, but the whole thing is really very simple, and Andrew said that he felt he understood it much more directly now. I didn't doubt it. That belching part was inspired. The next thing Andrew and I got into was what it meant to be in the world, but not of the world. This didn't take long, because the answer is largely the same as it is for non-attachment. It's nothing you have to worry about now, I told him. It's just something that takes care of itself when the time comes. There's no point in understanding it. He was not so easily put off, so I continued. From my perspective, I told him, unenlightened people seem like characters in a soap opera. That's what I see when I watch people with all their concerns and hopes and dreams and conflicts and dramas. That's not meant to diminish the human experience in any way, and anyone watching from my seat would say the same thing. But when I say soap opera, that's what I mean. A maudlin, hysteria-ridden, unconvincing, poorly scripted, and clumsily acted fiction of no importance and limited entertainment value. I used to be the same as anyone else, of course, living my life as an unwitting character in the soap opera. But now I'm not. Now I'm out of it and free to come and go. But what I can't do, barring a major head wound, is ever mistake the soap opera for reality again. So here I am, on stage right now, this very minute, speaking with one of the characters in the soap opera. This particular character has a storyline that revolves around breaking out of the soap opera itself. This particular character wants to know whether it has an existence outside the dramatic framework of the soap opera, or whether it is nothing more than a two-dimensional character that will cease to exist when the writers kill him off or the show gets canceled. Will this character succeed or fail in his bid for freedom? Will he continue in his quest or change course? Does it really matter? Tune in tomorrow to find out. Andrew was very still, very thoughtful. Wisely, he was not insulted, not taking things personally. He was listening, absorbing, but not countering or defensive. I was being a bit of an ass, I suppose, over-explaining, over-stretching already tenuous analogies, just trying to keep myself amused, I guess, but also testing ways of saying things and over-saying things. So, I continued, you, Andrew, are both in the soap opera and of the soap opera. You desire to break out of the soap, and that desire is the dangling carrot that, as actors say, provides your motivation, which in turn provides the dramatic impetus for many tragicomic Andrew-centric episodes. And eventual success? He asked. I waved a hand dismissively. Oh, yeah, sure. You can't manage to avoid your own true nature forever. It's a wonder that anyone manages it at all. Andrew frowned. You make it sound like enlightenment is... what? Well, like nothing. Unimportant. Like it's... beside the point, I supply. Imagine that you're watching a soap opera on television, but you have the power to step into it. One minute you're watching a goofy TV show, the next minute you're in a hospital room, visiting a character who is dying of brain cancer. It's real to him. He's in the pit of despair. But to you, he's just an actor playing a role. Nothing is really at stake. How much genuine empathy do you have for his plight? But he's just a fictional character. I stared off into the distance and waited. I'm just a fictional character, he said flatly. I'm the one with brain cancer. You've stepped into my soap opera. This is a good lesson, a fun one. Analogy-wise, I could make it a Broadway production of Hamlet instead of a soap opera, but that would tend to glorify these fictions rather than trivialize them. The soap opera analogy is very succinct in making the two points that Andrew and I have been toying with. One, that Andrew himself was a fictional character, and two, that all importance is illusory. But there was another point to touch on while we were in the neighborhood. And who created your character? I asked him. You mean, who made me what I am? Who is the author of you? Well, to some degree, I am, Andrew replied. Okay, then who is the author of the you that you say is, to some degree, the author of you? He gave that some thought. My true self? Oxymoron. There is no true self. Truth and self are mutually exclusive. This is like the nature versus nurture debate about how we develop. Okay. So there's really no answer. Sure there is. What? Not you. The author of you is not you. So I'm... what? What does that make me? I don't know. What does it matter? Well, obviously, he began, but fell silent. There's nothing obvious about it, I explained. There's no comprehending the vastness and complexity of the influences that go into creating the false self. A redundant term, but that's not a problem because there's no benefit to comprehending it either. There is a benefit, however, to realizing that who you are has little or nothing to do with you. It may be difficult to imagine not taking yourself personally, but it can be done when you see clearly that who you are has little or nothing to do with you. Me who? Well said. We sat silently for a while, each with our own thoughts. I spent the time reviewing my own words for effectiveness and possible improvement. Andrew, understandably, spent those few quiet moments seeking refuge and stability in his Buddhist teachings, which I found out when he asked something pretty unrelated to what we had been discussing. But what about suffering? The Buddha said, stop. If I allowed students to steer these dialogues with their questions, all of our time would be spent going in every imaginable direction but forward. Students, quite naturally, think that it's important to understand. They think that it's vital that their information be correct and precise. They think that this is like school, where you have to understand one thing before you can understand the next thing. But all that is about knowing, and this is unknowing. All this so-called knowledge is exactly what stands between the seeker and the sought. I can certainly understand their perspective in all this, but I am always amazed when I see other teachers of this stuff letting students drag them uphill and down dale with questions that don't advance the cause. Waking up isn't a theoretical subject one masters through study and comprehension. It's a journey one makes, a battle one fights. Teachers want to be popular and appear wise, so they answer whatever questions anyone thinks to ask, as if they were teaching the next generation of teachers, rather than helping people wake up. And having said that, I am also constrained to say that this journey, this battle, has yet to even begin for Andrew. His many years of meditation and spiritual education do nothing to alter the fact that he has yet to take the first step on his own journey. The first step is the main thing. That's what everything I teach is really about. Take the first step, and the rest will most assuredly follow. You can traipse about the stage playing a spiritual role, and you can meditate and renounce and be selfless and earn merit and burn karma year after year, lifetime after lifetime, and still not take that first step. That really sums up the state of awakening in the West, where spirituality is a recent cultural transplant with many intoxicating blossoms but no established root system. In her book, Halfway Up the Mountain, The Error of Premature Claims to Enlightenment, Mariana Kaplan has this to say about the siren song of enlightenment. The most common, widely held fantasy about enlightenment is that it is freedom from suffering, the transcendence of pain and struggle, the land of milk and honey, a state of perpetual love, bliss, and peace. Enlightenment represents the collectively shared dream of an idealized and perfect world of pure beauty and joy. It is not only New Age fantasy, it is the secret wish of all people. It is our shared dream of salvation, but it is only a fantasy. In short, like most spiritual seekers, Andrew never signed up for enlightenment at all, but for a heaven-on-earth fantasy called, in this case, nirvana. The question is, once disabused of the fantasy, does the seeker's enthusiasm automatically transfer to the reality? In other words, if you ordered a hot fudge sundae with whipped cream and a cherry, would you be just as happy if the waiter gave you a poke in the eye with a sharp stick? Probably not. So now Andrew wanted to throw the Buddha at me, but I have no use for the Buddha, and though he didn't realize it yet, neither did Andrew. Suffering is irrelevant, I told him. Compassion is irrelevant. To begin with, neither one of us has the slightest idea what the Buddha said, because he didn't write it down and get it notarized. And since he's not here to explain, we're on our own. Andrew was wide-eyed at this heresy. I sensed that he was thinking about getting up and leaving. Hey, this is good news. What I'm saying is that you don't have to rely on the highly suspect teachings of someone who's been dead for thousands of years. You can rely on yourself. If Prince Siddhartha made it on his own, you can too, right? The Buddha was just some guy who got serious and figured it out for himself. So maybe that's his real teaching, that you can figure it out for yourself. Maybe the point isn't that he was some sort of deity or Superman, but that he wasn't, that he was just a guy like you or me. Andrew was rocking back and forth slightly, agitated. As to suffering, I continued, forget it. It's a non-issue. Suffering just means you're having a bad dream. Happiness means you're having a good dream. Enlightenment means getting out of the dream altogether. Words like suffering and happiness and compassion are just bags of rocks. Eventually, you'll have to set them down if you want to keep going. Andrew sat motionless, his inner turmoil obvious. Nobody likes to have their cherished beliefs dumped on, but dumping on beliefs is the name of the game. We sit quietly for several minutes before Andrew steers us back to an earlier topic. So we can't realize our Buddha nature by conducting ourselves in a Buddha-like manner. The Tao says that the sage walks in the world but leaves no footprints. This is just another way of saying in the world but not of the world. What the Tao doesn't say is that the unawakened person who wishes to become a sage must only travel in such a way that no mark is left on the ground. But can you imagine if a sect of anal Taoists read this passage as a directive to never disturb soil or dust, to never bend a blade of grass? It would be ludicrous, but no less ludicrous than many of the things people do to make believe they are the thing they hope to become. There's no point in acting like someone who is already where you want to be. The point is to get there yourself. The way to become a sage isn't to act like one. Become a sage first, and then you pick up all the sagely characteristics free and easy. The misconception about mimicking enlightenment as a way of becoming enlightened can be seen everywhere. If you want to be an enlightened guy, the thinking goes, act like an enlightened guy. If vampires really walked the earth, and I'm not saying they don't, there would be teachers and classes where you could sign up if you wanted to become a vampire yourself, as I suppose some people would. If the teacher were a vampire himself, he might just bite everyone and swap fluids or whatever, and presto change-o, they're all vampires. But if the teacher were just a regular human, and not really a vampire, then you might find him handing down specific rules for his students to follow. Don't go out in the sunlight. Don't eat garlic or drink holy water. Don't drive wooden stakes through your heart, and so forth. And vampire wannabes would stand in line and pay their money to hear it. Then they'd return to their lives and struggle to follow their teacher's instructions in the hope that, by doing so, they would eventually achieve vampirehood. But, as we all know, that's not how you become a vampire. That's how you become a Fruit Loop. It's the same thing with the non-attachment and the in the world but not of the world business. If you just want to be happy and acting like a vampire makes you happy, then super, that's definitely the thing to do. But if you want to become a vampire, then wearing black and getting your canines capped isn't going to do the trick. Another point Andrew raised that's worth considering here had to do with the edict, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. From the sound of it, this too is a subject of ongoing debate between Andrew and his fellow Buddhists. I said, enjoying fond recollections. I didn't know what that meant when I first heard it either. But you do now? Andrew asked. I think he was convinced that this was a koan-like statement, not really accessible to comprehension. Sure, I replied. It means something along the lines of, when you get to the second stoplight, take a left. Andrew just stared at me. "It's a travel direction," I continued. "It's not a priceless pearl of wisdom like wear a seatbelt or brush between meals. It's just a simple piece of advice like one traveler who's been to a particular place might offer another who is going there." Andrew still wasn't getting it, probably because I was amusing myself with guru babble. I made an effort to express myself more clearly. "On the road to enlightenment, there's one magic word. It's your mantra, your battle cry. The word is further. Very important. Big deal. We don't have to concern ourselves with the importance of further right now. Just take my word for it. Someday, maybe in this life, you're going to begin the process of true awakening, and a word like further can serve as a very powerful talisman. There's no real reason to dwell on the kill the Buddha thing now except to get it out of your head. By which I mean, there's no real benefit to you in understanding this except to not dwell on it anymore. The time will come when you understand it for yourself in totality. And after that, you'll probably never give it another thought, just like any single piece of direction on a long journey." Despite my cautious disclaimers, Andrew was on the edge of his seat, waiting to find out why he should kill the Buddha. There are times in the process of waking up when those who have traveled the path before you can come to your aid and provide a clue as to your next step. That's really all that any teacher or teaching can really provide, the occasional signpost. It may be in a big, general way, like the word further, or it may be in a small, specific way, like the kill the Buddha thing. When I went through it all, I did it without a teacher or guru, but I had the help of many previous travelers who had taken the trouble to leave signs and warnings and hints along the way. Poets, philosophers, sages, serious people. People who took the time to set down what they knew for those that would come after. I pause for a minute, unsure that I want to discuss this. I guess I do. It's a somewhat disconcerting aspect of the journey that you catch up to and go beyond some of your own mentors, move beyond people you've held in the highest possible regard. I was acutely aware of this occurring on several occasions, and I can tell you that it's a strange and daunting experience, all the more so because it's quite specific and unmistakable when it happens. These are the giants in the field, so to speak, and the simple though peculiar-sounding fact is that I became very close to these people, and in a very real sense, when I came to where they had stopped off, I stopped with them and paid my deepest respects, and moved beyond them with a heavy heart. I have no idea how that sounds to someone who hasn't experienced it, but it was a wrenching part of the whole thing, and it feels good to tell someone about it. Andrew seemed absorbed in my reminiscences. I was careful not to mention the names of my mentors to Andrew. The teachers we need will always be there when we need them. No need to track down someone else's. Kill the Buddha is one of these signs that has been left by a previous traveler. It has a very specific application. It has meaning at one particular juncture that one comes to on the path. Rather late in the journey, as I recall. It means nothing before you reach this particular place. Then the time comes when you're there, and the next thing you're supposed to do isn't exactly clear to you. In fact, the wrong thing seems quite correct and is extremely tempting. And then, as if from nowhere, this absurd little phrase about killing the Buddha pops into your head, and your heart swells with inexpressible gratitude, and you know what to do, and danger of slipping back into a coma is averted. I laughed at the power of the memory. That's life on the path, man. It's a trip. I spent a few moments in my own fond remembrances before summarizing for Andrew. It means further. At a very exact point in the journey, when it would be very easy to sit down and think you're done. It means, get up. You're not there yet. Don't be deceived. Don't be sentimental. Don't be complacent. Keep moving. You think you're there, but you're not. You're still seeing two where there's only one. That image you're kneeling in front of, whoever it is, whatever it is just another projection of your own bullshit. Kill the fucking thing and keep going. That's what it means. I looked over at Andrew. He stared back at me with unabashed awe. I can appreciate that. It's an awesome thing. Chapter 12. There is only one truth. In all 10 directions of the universe, there is only one truth. When we see clearly, the great teachings are the same. What can ever be lost? What can be attained? If we attain something, it was there from the beginning of time. If we lose something, it is hiding somewhere near us. Look, this ball in my pocket. Can you see how priceless it is? Ryokan. Chapter 13. I will obtain the ultimate truth. I was dreaming that I was a butterfly fluttering happily. Suddenly, I awoke. Now, I wonder who I am. A man who dreamed he was a butterfly? Or a butterfly dreaming it is a man? Chuang Tzu. Winter hasn't been particularly harsh this year. A bit cold early on, and a little lacking in drama blizzard-wise, but not bad compared to some. February, March, and April can be gray and depressing, and nerves can get a bit frazzled. But we were spared most of that this time around. We're now at the beginning of what's shaping up to be a wet spring. Wet or dry, spring is always very welcome here. It's rejuvenating to see color burst onto the scene after such a long absence. Suddenly, after months of seemingly interminable browns and grays, it happens as if from the wave of a wand. Color bursts from the ground and the trees and the sky as the whole thing just wakes up frisky. You only get a nice day every week or two in early April, so no one misses an opportunity to get out there and start prepping the gardens for the new season. I'm an old soul, if you care to look at things that way, and I feel like I'm supposed to be out there puttering around in a cutting garden or tending grapes and communing deeply with nature, but I'm not really coded for that. Sometimes I'll mow the grass if I can find the tractor, a full gas can and a bit of motivation all at the same time, but as you might guess, those three planets don't line up too often. I'm not totally inert, mind you. I go for long walks and bike rides every chance I get. I usually walk alone, but when I go bicycling, I'll sometimes invite someone to come along, but not today. I stow my mountain bike securely in the back of the pickup and head into the nearby town, where I can enjoy a 15 or 20 mile ride through neighborhoods and nature trails and around the heart of the small downtown area. I drive to the park at the edge of town and prepare the bike for riding. As I'm getting ready, a serious bicyclist, complete with helmet, gloves, bike shorts, and those shoes that clip to the pedals, pulls up and strikes up a conversation. She's a pretty blonde, petite, almost frail, probably not even 18 yet. "You're Jed, aren't you?" she asks. My ride is off to a bad start. This is why I don't come into town much. I seem to have developed a low-level fame, just enough to cause occasional discomfort, like now. I admit to being Jed. "Cool. I recognize you. My name's Julene. I've been out to the Jed Zone a few times. I've seen you there." I smile. She's pleasant. Being recognized annoys me more in theory than in practice, I guess. The Jed Zone thing makes me laugh. I've heard it before. There's some buzz in town about the house, and I'm sure there are some rumors I'd rather not know about. Of course, they need something to call the place. Jed Zone is cute. I remember seeing you, I say, but we've never spoken, have we? I'm being chatty. I do remember seeing her out at the house now that I picture her without the helmet, but I don't have to ask if we've spoken. I know we haven't. No, she says, laughing. I'm, you know, just a kid, really. I don't think I would have anything to say that would interest you. I have my bike set up with water bottles and my little bike bag with a copy of Ramurti S. Mishra's book, Fundamentals of Yoga, tucked away, in case I find a shady tree to sprawl out under. I don't get on my bike just yet. What were you doing out at the house? I ask. I can't bring myself to call it the Jed Zone. Did you come out with friends? Yeah, she says. She starts rattling off the names of some people, only one of which I recognize. She explains that they came out a few times the previous summer and fall to do some work on the gardens and to strip and paint one of the outbuildings, and then for a bonfire one night as well. Well, that taps me out for the small talk, I tell her. Would you like to ride together for a while? She would. I make the usual lame excuses an almost 40-year-old guy would say before launching into a physically demanding activity with a well-equipped and clearly athletic teen. We take off together and set a comfortable pace for a lap around the park before venturing into town and beyond. I am more open to company on bike rides than on walks, because biking is less conducive to conversation, especially when you're trying to maintain 12 to 15 miles an hour on wooded trails or when you're riding in traffic without strict observance of the rules of the road. It's a nice day, and the ride is very pleasant. I can hold my own with Jolene without straining too much, or maybe she's taking it easy on me. We dart through some subdivisions with smooth roads and then into some paved trails that take us out of town for several hilly miles, letting us build up to a fun speed before ducking into an entrance to a forest preserve. In the preserve, we stay mainly on paved roads because Jolene's bike isn't built for rough terrain. Eventually, we turn and head up a steep hill that I can only climb halfway up before dismounting and pushing my bike. She continues riding, but in a back-and-forth pattern that keeps her close to me. Show off, I grumble. She laughs. At the top of the hill, I step up onto one pedal and coast along to an unpeopled picnic area overlooking a small lake. I pull out a water bottle and drink while I get my wind back. I think I'm going to sit around here for a few minutes and read, I tell her, assuming she'll take that as her cue to move on, half hoping that she won't. Can I hang around with you some more? She asks. I have a book, too. I won't pester you. I've never been around a real live mystic before. I chuckle at that. Yes, you can hang around if you like, but I'm afraid I'll have to disappoint you on the mystic thing. I'm not a very mystical guy. She has no response to that. Instead, she surprises me by snatching my book away and tossing me hers. I guess pretty young girls can be impertinent and flirty like that, but it's been a while since I've been on the receiving end of it. Out at the house, everyone tends to be a little reverential, which can get tedious. The book she sticks me with is one of those little collections of Zen aphorisms compiled by an editor who probably got stuck with the project during a lull in the Calques of Borneo publishing cycle. Hard to blame them, really. If I had a publishing house, I'd pound out little Zen books as fast as the editors could rustle up profound-sounding quips by anyone with an Oriental name or title. As long as the cover design bespeaks elegant simplicity and everything inside is unintelligible, you have a surefire hit. It could be worse than a little Zen book, of course, even a bad one. I don't know what the typical teenage girl reads, but I am grateful that this one reads Zen instead. She is settled on the grass near the lake, and I join her. I flip through her book enough to confirm that it's a piece of crap. When you boil water for rice, remember that the water is your own life. And, having nothing better to do, begin to read. "Wow," she whispers to herself after a few minutes. I look up to see if she wants to share whatever has caught her attention, although I already know what it is. The page is dog-eared, the spine flops open to it, and the passage is framed in faded yellow highlighter. She reads aloud the clearly marked passage ascribed to Buddha. I know it well, but it's pleasant to hear it read by someone for whom it's new. "I will obtain the ultimate truth and ultimate reality," she reads slowly, thoughtfully. "That is the ultimate aim of my life in this world, whether my body may remain with me or go to pieces. My bones and flesh may go into complete annihilation or remain with me. I shall obtain the true form of the universe. Through innumerable incarnations, good results, I have obtained a human body. I will not lose this golden opportunity and will certainly obtain samadhi and the real form of consciousness. Calamity may come or go. Mountains may break upon my head, but I will not leave my promise to obtain nirvanam." She sets the book down and just stares off beyond the lake. I too relax into a quiet reverie. That's a very nostalgic passage for me. It's the reason I chose that book to bring. The writing of my book is making me take a look back into my own journey of awakening, in which that particular statement of purpose played an important role. I resonated with it when I first read it all those years ago, and made a point of rereading it often. If I wanted to pass it on to a student today, I'd probably trim it back a bit, but I'd leave the intensity of the commitment intact. That passage figured largely in my efforts to define and state my intent way back when, and it didn't hurt to have a heavyweight in the enlightenment game to identify with either. "Mountains may break upon my head," she whispers to herself. After a few minutes, she picks the book up and thumbs through it. "Do you do yoga?" she asks. "No. Basically, that book is a souvenir from an earlier time in my life. I went through a lot of books back then, but I held on to that one because of the part you just read. As you can see, it's a pretty moldy and tattered book. It's spent a lot of time in pockets." She smiles appreciatively. "You don't like my book, though, do you?" The conversation turns. This is what happens. Is she asking me a question, or just shooting the breeze with Mystic Jed? I don't particularly want to slide into the teacher groove, unless that's what she's asking me to do. I'm never comfortable going there without a pretty clear signal. I'm afraid I'll come off like one of those people who you ask, "How you doing?" and they spend the next hour actually telling you. "Just not my kind of thing," I say, skirting. "You're not into Zen?" "Oh, boy." I lay back with my hands behind my head and mark the passage of a cloud that looks like Marilyn Monroe when the air vent blows up her skirts. Or maybe it's a Rorschach cloud, and my interpretation is warning me about dallying in the grass with pretty young females. "Really?" she says. "I'm interested." Well, that's all it takes to get me rolling, but I'm still reserved. "There are two Zens," I say. "One Zen sells books and miniature sand gardens and calligraphy sets and little Buddha statues. The other Zen is about enlightenment." "My book is the bad one, huh?" she asks. I laugh. "Yeah, it's the bad one. I just started learning about Zen a few months ago," she explains. "It seems really cool. I've read a bunch of books about it, and I went to a meeting where a Japanese man talked about it. Do Do you think all the books I read were like this one?
Depends what you got from them. Zen has a very alluring patina to it. People find it very attractive to read about Zen and maybe practice Zazen meditation. Have you bought all the special pillows yet?
She has.
What else?
The little sand garden, she admits with a self-conscious smile. A statue of Hotai, the Laughing Buddha.
Yeah, I like that one too, I say.
So, that's nice. You enjoy it. You like reading about it. And you can accessorize. There's nothing wrong with that.
But it's not really Zen, is what you're saying.
No, it's not really Zen. It's more like Zen's pretty cousin. Real Zen isn't pretty, and you don't need any books for it.
That's the long and the short of it. I didn't want to come down on Jolene's new hobby too harshly, but I have a real love-hate relationship with Zen. Rather, I love Zen and hate new Zen. Real Zen is about the hot and narrow pursuit of enlightenment, the shortest distance between asleep and awake. No rules, no ceremonies, no teachings, just the muddy, bloody battle of waking up. New Zen, the Zen that drives a publishing and merchandising industry, is all about being asleep and staying asleep. Of course, by saying this, I'm risking the wrath of all those sunshine enthusiasts who believe that Zen is something you read about and practice and eventually master, as if Zen was a hobby or a religion or a social activity, as if Zen was something that could be done in addition to anything else, as if Zen was about being mindful or mindless or present or silent. But if they're truly interested in waking up, then those miffed Zen buffs are exactly the people who should be grateful for this wake-up call, because they're the ones who wanted to make a journey and were duped into sitting down and going nowhere by Zen's pretty cousin. The decisive test is always the same. How many enlightened? No ifs, ands, or buts. No other objective or benefit is of the slightest interest. Where is the steady outflow of awakened beings? Ugly Zen has them, and pretty Zen doesn't. Period.
So, it's like Zen's evil twin, she says.
I laugh at that. Yeah, the evil twin bonked the good twin on the head and banished him to a distant island where the evil twin sold out for fame and fortune and took over the world. We idly play with that scenario for a few minutes, stretching it further and further, just enjoying the ease of the moment and the warmth of the sun.
Everybody knows you're a mystic, Jolene says, shifting gears on me. Why do you say you're not?
I let out a groan as I sit up and wrap my arms around my knees.
Okay. I'll answer you if you tell me what you like about Zen.
Okay, she says brightly.
Well, when Mr. Yamamoto was here, he spoke...
I interrupt. Mr. Yamamoto or Yamamoto Roshi?
Yeah, Yamamoto Roshi. He talked about one-pointedness and life in a Zen monastery and all sorts of things that sounded really interesting. He told a lot of great stories about people who would do Zen and then just out of the blue, bam, they'd be enlightened. Maybe someone would say just exactly the right thing at just the right time and bam.
Yeah, pretty cool, huh?
It was. She was up on her knees now, excited. He talked about the history of Zen and all that, and he showed us a video about his monastery in North Carolina, and it all just seemed, I don't know, really cool.
So you started reading about it, and you did some online shopping.
I bought a book from the people who sponsored his visit, and yeah, I went online and picked up the pillows and some other books. The sand garden I got at a store in Iowa City, and some used books about Zen and Buddhism, too.
Did he say what enlightenment was? I asked.
She thinks about this for a minute.
He talked about samadhi, Or was it Satori? You think I'm silly, don't you?
I laugh. No, I like Zen, too. I liked it long before I understood it, kind of the same way you do now. Your turn, she says. I remember our deal. Okay, but you may not find it very interesting. I say I'm not a mystic, because I'm not. Or maybe just a minor one. It's actually a pretty confusing issue, but what I am is different from being a mystic.
What are you?
I'm enlightened. And that's not the same as being a mystic? No. They sound like the same thing, but once you actually get into it, there's a big difference.
Which is better? Being enlightened, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mystics suck. Enlightened guys rule. She laughs and pushes me. I laugh, too.
No, really, she says. What's the difference?
No, really, I mimic her. It's not that interesting. She settles down and meets my gaze levelly. Can I say something, please? I don't know how I got so lucky that a few months after I start, you know, getting interested in Zen and spirituality and everything, that I wind up spending an afternoon with... She falters a bit. It's like God or the universe or my higher self or whatever is saying that I'm doing something really good. It's saying, here, you want to know, so here's the guy. Here's your chance. So I'm sitting here with you, and you're very nice and everything, but you're also probably, this is weird, seriously, you're what everybody, she is trembling and on the edge of tears. You're really truly enlightened, aren't you? No messing around. I mean, I know you are. You're really it, aren't you? I'm rarely taken aback. I consider her carefully before responding. Yes, Jolene, I say. I'm really it. She's nodding her head, absorbing, processing.
Yeah, yeah. See what I mean? That's what I mean. I mean, what are the odds?
I watch her for a moment, admiring the depth of sincerity in her eyes. Okay, I say. I understand.
So the thing is, you know I'm young, and I don't get it, and you're being really cool with me, but I do want to know. I am interested. I don't want to be just another... What's like the Buddha said, I will not lose this golden opportunity.
She falls silent, her lower jaw quivering, and her eyes moist. And so we sat there for the next several hours while I solemnly answered her questions about the difference between enlightenment and the many varieties and degrees of mysticism, about the difference between the real Zen and the Zen that sells books, about Hinduism and meditation and Christianity and Native Americans and the American Transcendentalists, about whether Brad Pitt could possibly be any greater, and all sorts of lofty things. But mostly we talked about Plato's cinema.
End of Disc 3.